I would be remiss if I did not express my appreciation to your fellowship here for the invitation to come and speak, for your kindness today and your hospitality and the nice things that have been said and done on my behalf, and also for the wonderful meal that somebody paid for. We went to this little place called Christie's, and I walked through the buffet, and I loaded up this plate, and I ate, and they kept bringing me drinks, and then I got up and walked out and didn't give anybody any money. So I hope I didn't steal that. I assume somebody bought my lunch, and I want to thank the elders for doing that. And I have been at Graymere several times with Rusty and with Kirk for the preacher's camp and a youth minister seminar. I did not know that there were fellowships like this in the brotherhood with solid elderships and solid ministers and guys who think about Scripture the way I think about Scripture. And when I came here and met Kirk and Rusty and Chuck Morris and John David and that group of guys that I met here the first time, it revitalized my spirit, because I sometimes felt like Elijah, and God said, no, I got 7,000 guys that's not on the other side. And this has been a blessing in my life to be involved with people of your fellowship, and then to get to spend the day with you all. I really have appreciated it. A little boy took his friend to church with him one time. The little boy's friend was unreligious, had never had any experiences in church whatsoever. And they're sitting there in the pew, and the guy gets up and he lets out a number. 425. The little boy says, what does that mean? He said, that's a number in your book that you look up, and that's the song we're going to sing. Well, they go through the singing a little bit, and then the men stand up to do the communion. The little boy says, what does that mean? The little boy explains that's the bread, represents the body of Jesus. They handed out the cup. The little boy says, what does that mean? And he explained it. They do the contribution. The little boy, what does that mean? Then the preacher gets up to preach. The preacher gets up to preach, and he looks over his audience. He pulls his watch off. He looks at it, lays it down. The little boy says, what does that mean? He said, that don't mean nothing. I apologize that my clock looking doesn't mean nothing. And I normally don't let the time get away from me like that. I owe your Bible class teachers an apology. Your time and preparation to prepare your classes is as important as anybody's. And I stole some of that time from you today. And if you'll accept my apology, then I'll consider that a blessing on your part. And I do apologize for speaking over as long as I did this morning. When you talk about raising spiritually self-reliant children, one of the components here is just raising children. Probably 80% of my private practice is in families. And 75% of the 80% of the family issues that I deal with would be either husband and wife or parenting kids. So we're going to spend a little bit more time this afternoon or this evening talking about raising spiritually self-reliant children. We're going to get into that third component. And from 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, we said that parents encouraged, comforted, and urged. And the urging part is where I'd like to camp out a little bit tonight. That urging part basically is discipline. It's the idea that I'm going to train you to do some things that are kind of against your nature. Teenagers, young people, can be difficult. First of all, when they come into our lives, you don't realize how vulnerable you can be. You realize how little control you have of the rest of your life. Because my life is wrapped up in my daughter's success and well-being and happiness. And I never realized that I could be as vulnerable as I am. And so sometimes it's hard to make the difficulties of parenting simply because we love those children so much that we almost become victims of doing too much for them or giving them too much leeway. On the other end of that, sometimes we have children and those children are not angelic. If you have your Bibles and want to just real quick look at Genesis chapter 16, verse 11. I love this verse. I would not have liked to have gotten this news. I remember when we got the news that we're going to be parents, what a wonderful time it was. How'd you like to have had this announcement? Genesis 16:11, and the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you are with child, and you shall bear a son, and you shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard your affliction. And he will be a wild donkey of a man, and his hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand will be against him, and he will dwell in enmity in the presence of his brethren. Folks, attention deficit disorder in the Bible right there. You got one of those little guys? You've had him in vacation Bible school, I guarantee you. What do you do when it comes to disciplining to raising children? Discipline starts at home, and it is the foundation for a child becoming self-reliant. It goes back to that idea from Stephen Glenn that says, my behavior influences my outcomes. If you do the things that we've asked you to do, you get good things. If you don't do the things we ask you to do, you get bad things. Jesus Himself and God and the apostles said, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, that your days may be well with you and long upon the earth. This is the first commandment with a promise. In other words, if you do what you're supposed to do, things will go good. If you don't do what you're supposed to do, things won't go good. So when we begin to talk about raising spiritually self-reliant children, I'd like to talk just a little bit about discipline. I define discipline as putting stress in a relationship so the result is growth. Putting stress in a relationship so the result is growth. All discipline is not punishment. And all punishment is not discipline. Discipline basically involves in training. And then there's basically some rules that go behind the discipline thing. In my framework of belief, all human behavior is reward motivated. I do what I do because it gets me something I want. And that's just it. Now, I don't always understand that as clear cut A, B, C, D is the linear sequence. But typically, we act the way we act because we get reinforced by the results we get. Children who throw temper tantrums and get their way will throw more temper tantrums. Guys who lose their temper and people walk on eggshells to keep them from losing their tempers develop a dysfunctional way of interaction simply because they've learned, I can blow my top and be a jerk and people stay out of my way. Had a guy in my office who had an explosive anger problem. And I asked him, I said, do you have any friends? He said, no. I said, do you have any social interaction? He said, no. I said, do the people you work for like you? He said, no. I said, then why do you do this? He said, I don't have any hassles. He says, I win all my arguments and don't have to do anything I don't want to do. And he had made a decision that his behavior was getting him things. So when kids behave a certain way, when kids do a certain thing, and even as adults, we do the things we do because it gets us something we want. All behavior is reward motivated. If you remove the reward, the behavior will self-eliminate. When my behavior cost me more than it cost you, I'll change my behavior. Now, you've heard this. You can lead a horse to water. What's the other side of that? But you can't make him drink. Now, what's the next line? Oh, there's a next line. You can lead a horse to water. You can't make him drink, but you can put salt in the oats. And if you put enough salt in those oats, that horse will drink water. I promise you. Every single time. And I'm not going to get that horse to the water trough and fight and fuss with him about water. I'm going to win that battle in the barn. Now, moms and dads, you can win the battle of discipline in the barn if you'll do that. But the reason we don't do that is because sometimes we get sidetracked. The first thing we do is we make a mistake in that we take it personal. Discipline is not personal, it's business. Remember the chart we showed this morning that children come into the world and they have no independence and they're seeking independence? Well, as children get older, they're trying to find the boundaries. And children naturally want to grow up and be separate from us and they want freedom. They want to do what they want to do when they want to do it, but sometimes they're not mature enough to make good decisions. Is there anybody in the building here who's 16 years old? I'm not going to make you come forward, just kind of wave at me. Anybody 16 that'll admit it? 17. 18? All right, come on. Let's suppose, how old are you? 19? 18. How many times have you been 18? That is correct, one time. At age 18, he is as old as he's ever been. He's got all the experience he's ever had. He's got all the responsibility he's ever had. He feels like at age 18 he has arrived because he is as old as he's ever been. But 18 looks pretty young to me. I've got a climbing harness that's 18 years old. This tie may be 18 years, I don't know. But see, teenagers, when they get to a certain age, feel like that, hey, I'm an adult, I'm a man, I'm a senior, I've got a job, I've got a car. And so they are pushing for that independence, and when we interfere with that independence, they play manipulative games with us. Oh, you've hurt my feelings. Oh, I wished I was adopted. I wish I wasn't adopted. Whatever they say to us, they do those things. And as parents, we've got to say, this is not personal. This is just business. If you hadn't seen the Bugs Bunny cartoon with the sheepdog and the coyote, you need to watch that. The sun comes up, the sheepdog and the coyote walk out to the field and they've got their lunch boxes. Good morning, Ralph. Good morning, Sam. They punch in their time clock. The sheepdog sits on the hill, the coyote goes down and tries to steal sheep. Every time the sheepdog catches him stealing sheep, he pounds him. The whistle blows, they go have lunch together. Whistle blows again, they go back to work. Parents, you're sheepdogs, your kids are coyotes, it's not personal, it's business. Their job is to seek independence, your job is to interfere with that in such a way that you allow them to learn life's lessons without having to pay the ultimate price of the mistakes that kids will make. Don't make the personalization error. Your job is not to keep your children from having their feelings hurt. Your job is not to keep your children from being disappointed. Your job is to teach them that when they run into the limits of life, they've got to make some kind of adjustment. Now let's back this up with Scripture. Hebrews chapter 12. In Hebrews chapter 12, the Hebrew writer is talking to his audience. He's telling them, you don't need to quit following Christianity and go back into Judaism just because it gets tough. In fact, as he talks to them about the roll call of faith in chapter 11, he says, here's some people who didn't quit because circumstances got tough. And then in chapter 12, he says, you've got to remember that you've got to live with endurance. You've got to make some choices about what's good and what's bad. And by the way, when you suffer, you must view suffering the same way that you view discipline from your parents. And then he makes some assumptions about suffering and discipline. And so we want to talk about discipline. I think this is a good place to make kind of an inference or make some extrapolation from what the Hebrew writer says. So here's what he says about discipline. Hebrews chapter 12, verse 5. And you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as sons. My son, do not despise the chastening. And if you want to really look that word up, you could substitute the word discipline there for chastening. And I may just say it both. I may say chastening or discipline. My son, do not despise the discipline or the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by Him. For whom the Lord loves, He disciplines or chastens and scourges every son whom He receives. Now, if you endure chastening or discipline, God deals with you as with sons, for what son is there whom a father does not chasten or discipline? But if you are without discipline or chastening, of which you've all become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. The first thing is, when we decide that we're going to discipline or train our children, it's got to be because we love them. The Bible says that the reason God lets us suffer is because He loves us enough to train us. If you don't care anything about a person, if you don't care anything about someone, then you don't invest any time into them. You don't invest any energy into them. My daughter is at college. And she plays volleyball. She is 4'10", plays college volleyball. She's a Jones. And she's going down there and she's going to get a little scholarship for playing ball. I told her before she left home, I said, now I want you to understand this. When you get down there and play volleyball, that coach is not going to be like any coach you've ever had. Because he's not some high school teacher who is investing some time into a high school team and she teaches science or PE. I said, his job and his only job is to be a volleyball coach. And his job depends on whether he wins and his job depends on whether he loses. I said, so if you're down there in a volleyball game and you throw that ball up to serve it and you hit it and that ball hits the net, one coach is going to yell, garbage! Another coach is going to clap and cheer. Now, which coach is your friend? She said, Daddy, tell me that again. I said, you're playing in a college volleyball match and you hit the ball in the net. One coach is going to scream at you. One coach is going to clap for you. Which coach is your friend? She says, well, Daddy, the coach who claps and cheers coaches for the other team when you miss a serve. I said, that's right. People who celebrate your mistakes don't want you to be successful. They're glad when you lose. They're glad when you mess up. They're glad when you don't do what's right. The guy who's investing $10,000 in your education, the guy who wants you on his team, the guy who wants you to develop as a player, and the guy who wants you to develop as a person, the guy who cares the most about you will scream the loudest at you when you mess up. Because people who don't care anything about you don't care whether you mess up or not. But the people who love you sometimes have to discipline you and fuss at you and yell at you when you mess up. If you love your children, you will discipline them. Second thing about discipline. Chapter 12, verse 9. Furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? If the motivation for discipline is love, one of the byproducts of discipline has got to be respect. When our fathers gave us rules and we broke them and then we got punished for that, we learned to respect our fathers. When you have a rule at your house and children don't obey it and children don't follow it and nothing happens to them, they learn you're just all talk. Discipline has to have basically three components. It's got to be immediacy, severity, and consistency. When you have a rule and somebody breaks it, if you've got a procedure and they don't follow it, then your response, first of all, has to have immediacy. You've got to do it then and there. It's got to have severity. It's got to be tough enough that it gets their attention. And thirdly, it's got to be consistent. You've got to be willing to enforce that rule every time that rule is broken. And every time they test you, you've got to have the same response. Now, if I can make you get into an emotional fit, if I can make you have to fuss and lecture, and as a parent, you basically got to be like a referee in a football game. You just throw that flag. I don't like you or dislike you. You got offsides. I threw a flag. Here's your penalty. When they do things they shouldn't do at your house, just throw the flag and don't get all wrapped up about it. But so many times we want to take it personal, and then we want to be careful that their feelings aren't hurt or they're not mad or they don't have a bad day, and we don't be immediate, severe, and consistent. Now, I'm going to quit preaching a minute and go to meddling. Does anybody hear speed? Oh, yes, you do. Tell the truth. Now you're in the building. You know why we speed? Well, first of all, we speed because when they catch us, you don't have to pay them right then and there. You get to wait 6 or 8 weeks and cut them a check, right? It's not immediate. Second of all, it's not very severe. My best friend lives in Atlanta. They got married right out of college. They chose not to have children. He's a CPA. She's some kind of a high-powered teacher. And they have his and her Corvettes. Paul's the only guy I hang out with that talked about his other Corvette. Coming home from Atlanta, some kid pulled up beside him in a car. He said, I was in the blue Corvette. He said, that's just my cruiser. He said, and this kid wanted to race me to the next red light. He said, I rolled down the window and said, be here tomorrow. I'll be in my other car. Now, that other car is scary. You can be driving about 50 miles an hour and punch it and break the back tires loose. It's a scary ride. But his other Corvette, and he told me, he says, it's worth $100 every 6 or 8 months to go as fast as I want, when I want, to get there when I want to. He said, because most of the time a cop car can't catch me. Well, it's not immediate, and it's not severe. And for every time you've been caught, how many times have you sped? It's not consistent, right, church? Now, what happens if the next time they pull you over, that young officer snatches you out of that car, shoots you in your accelerator foot, implants an electrode in you, and when that needle goes past that number, it shocks you? You'd sell that car and get a Yugo, wouldn't you? You'd have yourself a bicycle tomorrow. Why? Immediate, severe, and consistent. And our kids know whether or not we are meaning what we say or we don't mean what we say. I don't advertise myself as a child psychologist. I just am a licensed professional counselor. But I've wanted to print me up a stack of cards that say child psychologist and just hand them out at Walmart. Sometimes I just have to go home because I just want to go, you know. I get on the other side of the aisle, spank him, spank him. And just, you know, well, I learned the code at one Walmart, punch it in on the phone. We need a whipping on all four, a whipping on all four. You know, because these little kids are running these parents' lives because they don't do immediate, severe, and consistent discipline, and they don't respect their parental authority. Now, folks, this tells too much about my character. And what I know about parenting, I don't know because I'm a good parent. I know because I had a good parent. My brother was valedictorian. He graduated in the top 1% of the nation. He made in the top 10% of anybody who's ever taken the law school entrance exam. He read 900 words a minute with 95 comprehension in the ninth grade. And then they had me. And I'm a social person. D stood for dates and diplomas. And so I just kind of enjoyed life. I'm a people person. And my dad dealt with me in ways that taught me how to be a good father. Not because I'm the model citizen, but I am the product of some good discipline. And what happens is that I knew which teachers meant business and which teachers didn't mean business. I played football for a little club. Got to run defensive end for them. It wasn't real football, but it was close as I've ever come playing real football. And I ran defensive end for 4 years with these guys. And the first play I did every time we got on that line, and the very first play, I was going to see what the referee was made out of. I was going to grab that guy, low block him, and chunk him to the ground. If he threw a flag, I knew it'd be a slow night. If it's some young, rookie, inexperienced kid from college and he wasn't willing to throw a flag on you, oh, son, what fun you can have running defensive end if you've got a referee who won't. And I knew real quick whether I was going to respect this guy or not. It was his job to control that. And that young man walked up to you and say, look, I see it happen again. You go into the shower. You play clean ball. Now, I understand that's a character flaw with me. His job is to be a referee, my job is to be a defensive end, and if you do your job right, I'll do my job right. If you don't do your job right, I'm going to hurt that guy. Your kids do the same thing. Your kids test you and see whether or not you'll throw the flag. Your kids push the limit and see whether or not you mean business. And if you show them that I told you, I'm not going to tell you again, that means you're going to tell them again. But when you teach them that you mean what you say and you say what you mean, they learn to respect your authority. Now, folks, I love my daughter. I don't know that I could love her any more than I do. And I hope she likes me. I hope she thinks I'm a cool guy. But if I have to choose between her liking me and her respecting me, she's going to respect me. She's got friends, and she'll outgrow them in a few years. But even my enemies respect me. And I will not live in a way that when I tell my daughter something, she thinks I'm just blowing smoke. The byproduct of discipline is respect. And when we do discipline right, our children learn to respect us, at least respect our values. And sometimes I've had conversations with Lonnie Beth, and I've said, honey, this is not about you, and this is not about me, this is not about me, and this is not about your friend. This is between me and God. I don't feel good about this, and I've got to stand in judgment and look at God and say, hey, I didn't feel good about it. I let her do it anyway. And I said, I'm unwilling to have that conversation. Some choices I make as a parent have nothing to do with you, have nothing to do with me and you, has everything to do with me and God. Now, you may disagree with the way I do it, but I'm planning to have a conversation with God about what I did with you when you were in my care. And I'm unwilling to say, I thought bad about this and compromised on it just because I didn't want you to cry. And when you live that way, at some point, children learn to respect you. Number 3, the byproduct of discipline. Verse 10, for indeed, for a few days they chastened us as seemed best to them, but He, for our profit, that we may be partakers in His holiness. The Hebrew writer says that God disciplined us in order to improve us. Ephesians chapter 4, when it talks about conflict resolution, says, don't let any corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but only what is good for necessary edification that it may impart grace to the hearers. I don't make a discipline issue out of anything that doesn't improve my child. There are some things that aren't right and aren't wrong. And I don't worry about those things. I'm afraid sometimes we get so wrapped up in parenting because of what we think other people think we ought to do as parents that we miss the point of parenting. I'm not going to declare war over whether she wears her jacket to school or not. If you don't wear your jacket to school and it's 30 degrees, you'll wear your jacket tomorrow, I promise you. when seventh grade girls go through that goofy stage where they don't have any real fashion sense. You don't have to have a war about what they wear to school. You go to school, there's a seventh grade boy that'll take care of that. Hey, Pippi Longstocking's called, wants her stuff back. You know, the seventh grade boys will call that business when they get to school. I don't talk about let them go to school immodest, but sometimes we have war about stuff that's just silly. I see these young ladies with these little babies in church. And that little baby starts to cry and starts to fuss and starts to wrestle. And you see them get concerned about what the other parents are thinking. Folks, we're sitting there telling the little kids, hush, hush. And God's whispering, wiggle, wiggle. If you hear them crying in church, you'll see them sitting over there when they're teenagers. And I don't parent my child based on your expectations of me as a parent. I parent my child in the areas that will improve her, make her a better Christian, a better person, or a better citizen. And everything else is off the table. And I'm afraid sometimes we over-parent about things that really don't matter, and we make mountains out of molehills. SWAT has a saying that you have to choose which buildings you decide to go into. And I'm afraid sometimes we get into fighting so many little skirmishes that we don't have the energy to handle the big stuff. And so parents only make discipline issues out of things that improve your child. God disciplined us for our profit. Now notice this next byproduct, that we may be partakers in His holiness. God says if you line up the way I ask you to, you can share with me in my holiness. Folks, if we don't discipline our children, they will not respect us. If they don't respect us, they don't respect the school. If they don't respect the school, they don't respect the civil government. If they don't respect the civil government, they will not respect God. Them participating in holiness starts with us making them to participate in the holiness of our home. And we only make discipline out of issues that are for their profit. Don't get into this business where you make mountains out of molehills. Next statement on discipline, Hebrews chapter 5, verse 11. Now, no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Now, folks, I don't want you to think I'm being flippant about the Scriptures, but it's just funny to me that sometimes when you translate out of Hebrew into English or out of Greek into English, the statement is just kind of funny. You're reading the Old Testament, the book of Judges, and she drove a tent stake through his temple, and so he died. I figured that part out way before we got to that verse. Well, no discipline seems to be joyful for the present. I understand it's not any fun to discipline children. You didn't have to tell me that. Disciplining children is not joyful for the present, but grievous, the King James Version says. It is hard work to do good parenting. Because I know you say, you know, I feel like I walked in the door and the first thing I did was got onto the kids. We got up this morning, it was a Saturday, everybody had the day off, and the first thing I had to do was put out a fire with the kids. Folks, it takes hard work to be a consistent discipliner. It takes hard work to do the hard work to make things right. If you don't do the hard work, if you don't spend the time with disappointing people, you're going to raise somebody who doesn't respect your authority. But if you put in the hard work, no discipline seems to be pleasant at the present, but is painful. Notice the rest of this verse. But nevertheless, afterwards it yields a peaceable fruit of righteousness by those who have been trained by it. If you'll do the hard work, if you'll put in the time and you'll put in the energy and you'll deal with the tears, yours and theirs, to do good discipline, the byproduct will be peace and righteousness. And when you don't get a crop of peace and righteousness, it's because you haven't plowed the field with the hard work and the pain of being a good person and disciplining. You read about Adonijah in the 1 Kings. And Adonijah rose himself up and said, I will be king. Because his father had never displeased him, interfered with him, or questioned him and said, why do you do as you do? Folks, our job as parents is to interfere, displease, and question our kids and ask, why are you behaving the way you're behaving? The motivation behind discipline is love. The byproduct is respect. The byproduct is their profit. The byproduct is them participating in holiness. And the byproduct is that they are trained. And with that training, they yield a peaceable fruit of righteousness. Now, young people, since you're here and you've heard me talk about the theory of how to deal with you, I need to go ahead and explain to you the way your parents think. Your parents are pretty simple-minded. in their limited view of the world, they make an assumption. You know, if they keep their room clean, if they can go to school from 8 to 3, surrounded by adults, be told where to go and what to do, if they can handle that with a reasonable amount of responsibility, I can trust them to do other stuff. But if you can't do simple chores at home and you can't at least bring home a C average at school, your parents say, you know, if they can't handle history, I'm not sure they need a bicycle. If they can't handle keeping up with their school books, I'm not sure they can handle the ski equipment when the youth group goes on a ski trip. If they can't handle the little stuff, they can't handle the big stuff. That's why your parents make such a big deal about clean your room, feed the dog, take out the trash, and make good grades at school. Because they're judging whether or not you can carry off big stuff by whether or not you can do small stuff. If I were in this room by myself with just the teenagers, I learned this example from Paul Evans. I usually ask teenagers if I can have a dollar. And sure enough, some little kid will hand you a dollar. They bring you a dollar. I get a hold of the dollar. This is not a magic trick. You're not going to get it back. And I rip it up. Then I say, can I get $5? You know what the teenagers will do? They'll laugh you out of the building. You go, why can't I get a $5 bill? They say, well, I saw what you did to a $1 bill. Ding. Folks, if you handle the little stuff foolishly, your parents won't trust you with the big stuff. You want more freedom in your life? Show your parents more responsibility. If you want more ability to go and do, show your parents that when you go limited places and do limited things, you do a good job with it. And what happens then is your parents see you being trained and responding to limits in such a way that they think that you're getting the message. Raising spiritually self-reliant kids basically boils down to the idea of having a clear-cut set of expectations. Now, if you're in a situation where you've got some very difficult children, and I understand sometimes teenagers can be difficult. In fact, I'd make an argument that when God asked Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, I would make the argument that Isaac was not a teenager. Because if God had asked Abraham to kill a teenager, Abraham would have said, sure, Lord, all right, what's next? Because it just wouldn't have been that hard to do. Sometimes teenagers can get a little sideways with us. If you've got a teenager who, for some reason, attention deficit disorder, spectrum diseases, an attachment disorder, a conduct disorder, or just some of us are just paying for a raise and you've got a hard-headed kid who just is hard to deal with, there's a wonderful resource called Parenting the Out-of-Control Adolescent by Scott Sales. And basically, Scott follows Hebrews chapter 12, although he doesn't know it. But he basically says, when your behavior costs you more than it costs me, you'll change your behavior. But sometimes kids make choices about what they get from their behavior, and they're not very good choices. When our daughter was very little, I mean teeny tiny little, her and Jackie went to some hoodle doings at the church for the ladies. It was on a Tuesday night. Tuesday night is SWAT night for me. I usually report about 3 and hang out with the SWAT guys and come home about midnight. If I come home and Jackie is up, Jackie is hurt. She used to play volleyball on Tuesday nights where Lonnie Beth came in. The 2 times that she was awake when I came in from SWAT, she'd broken her foot. Well, I come in this Tuesday night and Jackie's up on the couch. I said, what's hurt? She says, it's not me, it's Lonnie Beth. I said, Lonnie Beth hurt? She goes, no, but we had this thing. Now, Lonnie Beth's probably 3 or 4. They'd gone to this ladies' thing at church. As they're going through the line to get the food, Lonnie Beth was just loading up her plate. And Jackie was putting stuff back. And Lonnie Beth was loading her plate and Jackie putting stuff back. Well, she got over there away from Jackie and she cut off this piece of cake that choked Conan the Barbarian to death. And Miss Jones says, if you get that, you will eat it. Jackie goes sits down with the ladies. Lonnie Beth went and sat down at the munchkin table, took one bite out of that cake, toddled that cake to the trash can and dropped it in. Miss Jones got up and got it out of the trash can. Set it down. Said, I've got a key to the building. We'll be here. Had this steady stream of little girls. Miss Jones, there's invisible things called germs, and if she eats them, she'll get sick. Jack said, I'm a science teacher. Back off. So, you know, we stay there. She said, honey, she said, it was embarrassing for me. It was embarrassing for her. It was in front of all the church ladies, but I made her eat that cake. I said, well, she called you bluff, and I guess you had to do it. So we go to bed. About 2 o'clock that morning, I hear these noises coming from the end of Lonnie Beth's end of the house. I get in my sweatpants and go down the hall, sit down the hall, and there she is on her little tippy toes, looking over into the toilet there. Baby, what's wrong? I'm sick. Why are you sick? Mama made me eat that garbage cake.
I said, why did Mama make you eat that garbage cake? I did not obey. And then she said, I thought she would whip me, but... And at 4 years old, this little cherub child said, you know what? You might spank me, but how about I ain't eating none of your cake? Well, Miss Jones made the right call and said, yeah, you're eating your cake and you go get a spanking. Children will make choices that sometimes we don't understand their value systems. And parents, you've got to be dedicated enough in your responsibility as God's steward in charge of those children to be willing to say, I'm going to see through this and I'm going to take the reward that you think you're getting out of this and I'm going to take it away from you and make you pay the price. Though he were a son, yet learned he obedience by the things which he suffered. Folks, our job is to control the will without breaking the spirit. And when we teach children that we want them to respect not only our rules but our values, that we love them and that the things we do for them is for their profit, that's when we can raise spiritually self-reliant children. In the story of Balaam, when Balaam is riding his donkey to curse Israel, and God stands an angel in his way, Numbers chapter 22. Balaam can't see the angel. The donkey can see the angel. I don't know what you know about angels. One angel in 2 Kings 19 killed 185,000 men. This angel is standing there with a drawn sword in his hand. He has pulled his weapon out of his holster. He is in combat ready position. This donkey sees him and turns. And Balaam beats the donkey. The angel moves over and the donkey turns again, crushes Balaam's foot against the wall, and Balaam beats the donkey. Finally, the angel's standing there, there's no place to go. The donkey lays down. And Balaam starts whacking on that donkey again. God lets the donkey talk. The donkey says, why are you beating me? Balaam said, because you've abused me. Now, I don't know how you read abuse into this, but Balaam's not the guy getting abused here. Then Balaam says, I wish I had a sword in my hand, because if I had a sword in my hand, I'd kill you. Now, if you were the donkey, what would you have said? If I were the donkey, I'd have said, you want a sword? Let me walk up here 15 more yards. You get all the swords you want. There's an angel standing there ready to die, slice, and julienne fry you. But you read the donkey's response. The donkey says, am I not your donkey? Have you not ridden on me since the day you had me? Have I ever treated you this way before? And Balaam says, no. The donkey says, you're unhappy with my behavior. You don't like what I'm doing and you think I'm losing my mind and it's causing you to lose your mind. Don't judge my behavior now based on my behavior in the past. Young people, your parents can see things you can't see and your parents know things you don't know. And when they tell you, you can't go to that concert or I don't want you with that boy or I don't want you with that girl, they're telling you that the same reason they wouldn't let you play with the electrical outlet when you didn't understand anything about electricity. They're telling you that because the same way they wouldn't let you play in the cabinet underneath the sink because you don't know anything about chemicals. They're telling you that because they understand some things the same way they wouldn't let you cross the road because you don't understand anything about physics. When you think about why my parents are acting so crazy just because I'm a teenager and at dating age, you ask yourself, why are they doing they're doing the things they do now because of the reason they did the things they did when you were little. They know things you don't know and they can see things you can't see. And parents, when you have these conflicts with your young people about rules and about values and about regulations, you go back to the story of Balaam and the donkey. And you say, you've got to trust me that I know some things about life that you don't know and I can see some things that you don't see. And by the way, folks, every law God has given us is just like an owner's manual. There's nothing God has ever asked us to do that doesn't help us. There's nothing God has asked us not to do that will hurt us. Because God says to stay away from things that are harmful and to pursue the things that will help us. God treats us just like a parent. And parents are supposed to function in our lives as representatives of God. And we tell you to do things that are for your benefit, and we tell you not to do things that are harmful. And young people, your parents can see things you can't see, and they know things you don't know. And that's raising spiritually self-reliant people. Two questions I have to ask you tonight. One is, if you're a child, are you in subjection to your parents? Are you making it difficult for them to be parents? Second question I have to ask you is, parents, are you in subjection to your father? Are you doing what your dad has asked you to do? Are you handling the responsibilities that he has given you? Do you take integrity to your job? Do you take honesty into your work? Do you take his influence into your community? Folks, being a spiritually self-reliant person just doesn't apply to teenagers. It applies to us as well. If your relationship with your parents is not right, young people, you need to clean that up. Parents, if you're not parenting the way God would have you parent, you need to clean that up. And if you're not living the way God would have us to live, we need to fix that too. Now, our lessons have been primarily on family today, and we've really not talked about the plan of salvation. But when you look at the concept of salvation, the bottom line behind Christianity is relationships. God built the world, put a man in it, and the first thing God said that was negative was, it's not good that man should be alone. Man needs a relationship. God gave him a wife. Adam and Eve in that relationship sinned and broke their relationship with God. God comes walking into the garden. Adam and Eve hide from him. He says, Adam, where are you? He said, I heard you and I was scared of you. God said, I'm going to fix that relationship. That's why we talk about reconciliation. God sent Jesus into the world to reconcile us, to bring us back together. The Old Testament law, the first five of the Ten Commandments are us and God. The next five of the Ten Commandments are us and us. If you break down the Beatitudes that we studied this morning, the first half is about us and God. The next half could be about us and us. When Jesus was asked to sum up everything it takes to be a Christian, He said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. Love your neighbor as yourself. Relationships. If you don't have a good relationship with God, all the other relationships in your life are compromised. To have a relationship with God, a person's got to believe that Jesus is the Son of God. Without faith, it's impossible to please Him. He that comes to God must believe that He is, and that He's a rewarder of them that diligently seek Him. Hebrews 11:6. After believing, a person needs to repent. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. That idea of renew your mind in Romans 12:2 is the idea of repentance. Changing the way you think, and therefore changing the way you live. After believing and repenting, a person confesses. Acts 8:37, the Ethiopian eunuch said, I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. After believing and repenting and confessing, a person is then baptized. You're buried in water and you rise to walk a new life. Romans 6:3-4. If you're not in a healthy, stable, submissive, obedient relationship to God, no other relationship you have in your life can work. It'd be a shame to end this family day and walk out of here without being in good relationship with God. If your relationship with God is compromised, you need to fix that tonight while we stand, while we sing.